Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to PhillyFanatics.com, Philly Sports Talk. I'm Eric Fisher. With me, Gordon Glantz. And we have a lot to talk about this week, and a lot of it's off the field. And we're going to start right off, Gordon, with Friday night. We lost, arguably, I think I'd be on this opinion, the most famous athlete in the world over the last 50 years, maybe over the last century. And that is Muhammad Ali, who died at age 74 Friday night, leaving behind an unbelievable legacy, not just his career, but also his life. So we'll get into both parts of that. Gordon, let's start with, I guess, the more important part, which is his life. What does Ali leave behind as his legacy?
Well, you know, I not to get too political, but, you know, I thought that because, you know, a little bit of my background, I mean, I'm always a very provincial guy. You know, it's always Philadelphia first and Philadelphia teams first. And so obviously, you know, I was the Joe Frazier guy growing up. And when I got a little older, it was, you know, Jimmy Young. He was the big heavyweight guy out of Philly. So, you know, Ali was sort of the bad guy in the ring. He was a guy you wanted the Philadelphia guy to defeat if you could. But when you kind of look back on it and you get a little older, you look back on his life historically, I think he really, his greatest fights were really outside the ring. I mean, he was a guy with not very much formal education who could, you know, go on to a talk show and you know, debate with William F. Buckley and could handle any question that Howard Cosell or other you know, sportscasters or sports writers could throw at him and really give answers that, while maybe they weren't in the King's English, were really profound and insightful. You could fill a whole, I'm sure everybody already has done this, but really a whole quote book full of Muhammad Ali quotes. And they weren't just words. I mean, he backed up everything. I mean, you're talking about a guy, whether you agree with him or not, I personally do agree with his stance about Vietnam. He refused to enlist in the Army. You know, he did it on the grounds that he was a minister of the Nation of Islam, which people didn't take too seriously back then. But I think that probably would fly now at this day and age. But back then, you know, it was just seen as maybe an excuse because he didn't want to go to war. But, you know, some of his reasons for it, I think, really fueled a lot of the anti-war movement that was around at the time. And most of that was on college campuses. And, you know, this was a guy who wasn't in that element, and he is saying, you know, well, why should I go, you know, fight other poor people in some country that, you know, didn't do anything to me? And, you know, I'm not quoting verbatim, but it was a stand that he took that cost him everything. It cost him his title. It cost him it cost him his profession. And he was already a married man with children and everything else at the time. And he was willing to go to jail for this. And, you know, and he had to put the pieces back together again as a fighter and rebuild his career. And he was willing to do that based on principle. And he remained, you know, a voice for justice and an admired voice for justice. And you know, somebody that when he spoke, people listened to him really from that point on. And he stood for more than just, you know, just the boxer. And he's arguably, you know, the greatest fighter of all time. He would go around saying I'm the greatest, but he would back it up in the ring. So, you know, that's kind of my take on what he was in terms of his life.
Well, yeah, we'll get back to the fighting part, but let's keep going with what you're talking about outside the ring. You know, I mean, you're right, what he gave up, I mean, he not only lost the heavyweight championship, he lost his career for 3 years. And, you know, and those stances were controversial for sure. The anti-Vietnam war stance, and, you know, and there were people, and I think rightfully so, who questioned that. I mean, whichever side you're on, I think we can understand both sides, you know, question why he wouldn't fight for the country. And also his claim as a pacifist, it's pretty tough when you're a boxer, although we used to have this discussion with Reggie White, you know, go ahead and beat the heck out of him for 3 hours on Sundays. But also he was a member of the Nation of Islam, which, you know, was endorsing the use of violence against civil rights. It's not exactly analogous to what we're talking about in terms of going to war. But, you know, he wasn't a pacifist with his stance on the Nation of Islam. So for other people, they called him a hypocrite and et cetera. I think the other thing, but even just joining the Nation of Islam and being public, and, you know, now we take for granted a lot of black Muslims who have changed their name or have gotten in the beginning, but people, you know, athletes who changed their name, and it's pretty prominent. But at the time, I mean, really, Ali, and then I guess Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was the next really big athlete to do that. You know, that was a pretty controversial stance at the time, given what the political climate was in the 60s with regard to, you know, civil rights and violence. And it was, you know, so Gordon, he didn't mind being a bad guy in the ring, and like you said, you rooted against him, and I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But, you know, it's his stance on social issues were, I mean, can you imagine an athlete today, and that's where I go with this, can you imagine an athlete today taking a similar stance on any issue?
No, not to that extreme. I mean, athletes do take stands on things, but to that extreme, unless you're just off the wall like a Dennis Rodman, who I think would just take a stance on anything just to be different. To that extreme, something like ripped from the headlines to, a device, something was so divisive in the country as the Vietnam War at the time. To give up as much, I mean, to be heavyweight champion of the world, and at that time, I mean, it really meant something to be heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, boxing was a huge sport. I mean, it's kind of become a splintered, you know, there's 28 different titles around now for every heavyweight division. You don't know who's who half the time. But, I mean, that you were the heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, you know, that was gigantic. And to give that up, I know that maybe the paydays, the purses weren't as huge as they are now because there wasn't cable TV and everything. A lot of fights just be on, you know, regular TV. But, yeah, to give all that up is to make that kind of stance. I can't picture anybody doing it. I mean, the only thing that I guess is somewhat close in the same galaxy with that is some of the football players who are willing to, you know, give up, you know, their careers because of the head injury situation. But it's still more of a personal choice than really a political or social stance. So, I really can't imagine anybody
and
giving
just going
up that
the other
much.
Way, and I don't want to get it. I don't want to get in conversation about him, but I mean, even when you're retired, Curt Schilling is going, going on the other side of things, but yeah, you know, he basically lost his job for, you know, tweets or things he said on political topics, and you know, so it's not just the athlete, you know, so maybe the athletes and the ex-athletes who are employed have good reason for not coming out on these things because you know, the people they work for don't want them to be doing that. And you know, it could cost you your job more. So, you know, that's a pretty good point. By the way, Gordon, I think, and your point about the decline of boxing, which has not gotten much publicity, but you're right, in terms of a accepted sport. I mean, God, I think I was a heavyweight champion somewhere in the early 2000s. I don't remember, but I think some organization asked me if I wanted to be champion. And I think I think I got a letter in the mail and asked me if I wanted to be champion because they had a new belt they were creating. But, you know, let's talk about Ali in the ring. First of all, you talked about, you know, bad guy. It's our colleague Ed Kratz, who's been on the show to talk about the Eagles before from Calkins newspaper. He had a post up on Facebook, and I thought it was interesting. And he said, you know, I don't think I ever rooted for Muhammad Ali any time when he was fighting. And I thought about it, and I think, Gordon, you start off the show this way. Yeah, you know, when he fought Joe Frazier, when he fought Jimmy Young, when he fought Ken Norton, generally, I rooted against Ali, and I think he was okay with that. He just cared that you were watching. You know, he cared that you bought the ticket and watched it. He didn't mind being the bad guy. And you know, and certainly with the Joe Frazier issue, and again, I don't want to get too far into this because he did just pass on Friday, but, you know, I mean, Ali deserved to be the bad guy there. It wasn't just a Philly thing. I mean, you know, he brought up some, you know, racially tinged comments about Joe Frazier and brought out a toy gorilla and things like that. I mean, he knew what he was doing, and he went too far with it there. But he, you know, he was being the bad guy. He was okay with being booed and having people root against him, again, as long as you watched it. But, you know, Gordon, one of the things I thought about is not just that, but and this was after Ed put that post up, and we went back and forth a little bit on it. You know, and you and I are about the same age. know, think about it. We didn't really, and this has to do with what you talked about him, what he sacrificed. We didn't really see him in his prime. Vance, you know, at really the early, you know, he had just made it. He had just made it in 64. It's 3 years later. He's on top of the world. He lost a lot of his prime. We'll say that. He lost a lot of his prime, and by the time I knew what was going on when I was watching a fight, by the time I was old enough to figure out what was going on, you know, when he beat George Foreman, he was 32 years old. So, you know,
I would say that really you could go so far as to say nobody saw him fight in his prime, because those 3 years may have been his prime.
Yeah. You know, and you go back and watch the fight against, and we have a list on PhillyFanatics.com. In addition to our story, we have a list of 15 most memorable fights. He beats a guy in 1966, a veteran by the name of Cleveland Williams, and I think they do like the CompuBox stats. They didn't have that then, but they've gone back. And I think in the 3-round fight, Williams only, and this guy, and Williams was not a, you know, he was on the back end of his career, but he was 65-5-1. He only lands like 10 punches in 3 rounds. And that's how good Ali was.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like a really good fighter. And the guy only lands 10 punches in 3 rounds. And, you know, and then 1 year later, Ali's done for at least for a little while. So, you know, I think we only saw him on the back end. But you saw him, you know, I saw him against Ernie Shavers. And even then, you look at the heart. So let's talk about whether he is the greatest for a second. And you know, I didn't see every heavyweight in the world. You know, and part of me was thinking, no, he's not, because I thought, how many, you know, really close decisions, and it was one of the reasons I didn't like him in the 70s. I thought he won some fights on points that he shouldn't have won. Even one of the, I don't remember if it was the second or third Ken Norton fight, you know, the Jimmy Young fight. You know, there were a bunch of real close decisions I thought he got that he probably didn't deserve and maybe dislike him more in the ring. But, you know, really, we'll think about the heart this guy showed. So, I'll give you a couple, Gordon, and we won't talk about any of them. One is the Ken Norton fight that he lost by decision, split decision, right, by the way. But he broke his jaw in the second round. Norton broke his jaw. And Ali makes it through the whole fight. And Ken Norton's no pushover. In another age, if he hadn't been in the golden age of heavyweights, Ken Norton might have been one of the great, you know, champions. Unfortunately, he was in there at the same time. He sort of spanned Joe Frazier, Ali, George Foreman, and Larry Holmes on the back end of that. You know, the Frazier fights, Thriller Manila being the perfect example. How much heart Ali had. Even to take the beating he took from George Foreman and, you know, the rope-a-dope, having the confidence to take those shots, you know, before coming out in the eighth round and knocking him out. Gordon, what does that say about Ali's determination, his heart, his stamina, even at, you know, it, for a boxer, would be old. He's in his, you know, early to mid 30s there.
I think his will to win has, you know, I think really drove him a lot. I think he felt like he was representing a lot of people, not just himself, when he stepped into the ring. Even though a lot of his rhetoric was I me mine, you know, kind of came across that way. But he felt like it wasn't just a Nation of Islam or anything like that. It was a larger community. I think he felt like he was representing. You know, there are people. I mean, going back to how you and I are a certain age and we didn't see him fight, so he was sort of the bad guy. And I'm sure we had, you know, parental figures or uncles. We all have that, you know, we all have that quote-unquote racist uncle or whatever that, you know, I'm going to call him Cassius Clay. I know Muhammad Ali, or, you know, I'm not going to call him by that other name. And, you know, he won fights he shouldn't have won. But I think that there, you know, for people like us, if we had been born a few years earlier, I think people who were his fans, I think we would have rooted for him, like in the Olympics, you know, because it became, you know, a star in the Olympics, and then we would have been more on his side going, you know, because he would have been that guy that we like from winning gold medals in the Olympics. We kind of came along after that and were influenced by people who maybe weren't, you know, as enthralled with the stance that he took at the time, which was not as popular as it is in retrospect. We can kind of put it in a historical perspective now. But I think he really had a will to win, and he was, for a guy his size, extremely well-conditioned most of the time. I mean, there were some fights, like you mentioned, that he seemed to go to distance with guys that were, I mean, I think Rocky was based on, I can't remember the fighter's name, but it wasn't Rocky based loosely on a guy who went the distance. Yeah, yeah. So
Actually, Ali stops Wepner with 19 seconds left in the 15th round. But yes, Chuck, it's the Chuck that Wepner fight.
Right, right, right. And Apollo Creed is so obviously based on Muhammad Ali. But you also got to think, though, I mean, because of the way boxing is today, and you mentioned the 70s really were a golden age for boxing. I mean, even beyond that, there were some really strong contenders. You know, we mentioned Jimmy Young before, and there were some other guys. And, you know, there weren't a whole lot of pushovers. And you know, you're going in there, you know, and when you're in that top echelon, you know, you're going to take a beat. You're in for a battle, and he knew that. And you know, how many fights today would be stopped? A guy breaks his jaw, I think pretty much the way Tao goes in the ring, it's almost automatic. I would think, you know, and instead you fight the rest of the fight with a broken jaw. And I would think the only thing they would let you go with is maybe a broken nose, maybe. In this day and age, but you know, I mean, again, one of those things when you look back through, you know, when you reflect back, just like on the Vietnam stance, when maybe it was controversial at the time, when you reflect back, the toughness that he showed against some really outstanding fighters and really Hall of Fame fighters, you know, a lot of these three times with Frazier and the fights with Foreman and everybody else. Yeah, I mean to keep going in the ring with those guys and to take a beating and give a beating, you know, on the north side of 30, like you said, you know, it really says a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And we could talk about Ali probably for 2 hours, but definitely the world, not just the boxing world, not just the sports world, but the world, a sadder place without Muhammad Ali. And check out PhillyFanatics.com. Like I said, we have a list of his 15 most memorable fights for good and bad reasons. And also, you know, a story about his death and his life. It's really more about his life than his death. So,
well, we didn't answer the question, Eric. Do you think he's the greatest or not?
Yeah, you know, I said my initial thing was no. And then, you know, because I said there were so many chances. And then I'm thinking, like you said, Gordon, you know, you look at the guys he fought. He fought Frazier 3 times. He's fighting Norton 3 times. He's fighting Ernie Shavers, who some people think is the hardest hitting heavyweight of all time. And Shavers rocks him in like the second round. And then I've been watching since he died. And then again in the 14th, Ali's wobbly and he survives. And, you know, Ernie Shavers. You know, so I'll say he's the greatest I saw. You know, it's hard for me. I can't go back and see Rocky Marciano and those Jack Dempsey and whatever. You know, I can't even really watch film of them. So he's the greatest I saw. And I guy probably gets underrated, and I'll throw that in there, is Larry Holmes, who comes to the back end. And the only thing Larry Holmes was missing was the great opponents that, like, Ali had. But,
right,
you know, you look
right
at the guys Ali beat, and it's – yeah, so I'll say he's the greatest I saw, yeah.
Yeah, I have to lean – I mean, some people would say Mike Tyson, but – I kind of really, a lot of those Mike Tyson victories to me were dubious. You know, not that he wouldn't have won anyway, but it seemed like he would get into the ring with somebody. And, you know, these were Don King productions. And Tyson would land one combination and they would stop the fight after 33 seconds or whatever. And I'm like, wait a second. You know, if this were the fights that we grew up on in the 70s, that would have been nothing, you know. But, you know, so he kind of padded a record with TKOs in the first round or second round all the time. But I'm like, did he really beat a guy senseless that early or not? So, you know, that's why I always put, like, I'm not quite sure how much on the up and up those Tyson fights were. I think he would have won those fights, but I think they were trying to keep him, you know, keep the image, build the image a little more than what it was at the time as well. So it's just a conspiracy theory I have. So, yeah.
But I think you're right. I also think if Customato had not died, Tyson might be in the discussion. But I think his skills faded after that. He was still a great puncher, but he wasn't the good boxer that he had been before that with the great defense and all that stuff that D'Amato had him doing also. Let's shift to another guy, and we don't want to get overlooked, because I think he has been overlooked, not this week, although by the end of the week he was, but even in history, and that is, and you wrote a column about this on PhillyFanatics.com, Gordon, and that's Rick McLeish, who died last Monday, I believe. You know, and when you go back and look at the numbers, and you're like, wow. You know, you look at, he's, you know, fourth in this category, sixth in this category, and I think people forget how important he was in the Broad Street Bully age. And Gordon, so talk about how maybe Rick McLeish, you know, as time's gone by, has become, I don't think he was at the time, but I think now you know, he's not on the TV, he's not on the radio, he doesn't have the colorful personality, you know, at least a public personality. Has Rick McLeish become underrated or underappreciated in Flyers history?
I think he definitely has. I mean, I think when you talk about if you gave people a test of what names you recognize more, and I think a lot of it is guys who are still in the public eye. I think people, especially not quite our generation, would probably recognize like a Bob Kelly more or Dave Schultz. And you're talking about Bob Kelly scored 4 goals in the 73-74 season. That was the first year the Flyers won the Cup, you know, or Joe Watson or some of these guys who are still around. They still do community work for the Flyers and or just had more flamboyant personalities like Moose DuPont. And I think those are the guys that for some reason, well, that's obvious why, you know, and you know, they all had nicknames. Well, Rick McLeish had nicknames too, I think, in the locker room more than, you know, I think they called him Crow or Hawk or different names like that. But I don't know
Hawk,
how many.
Yeah,
I don't think like we walked down the street calling that. He was just McLeish. So, you know, he didn't really have that kind of, but at the time, you're right, at the time there was no doubt that he was you know, Bobby Clark was a talented player who played extremely hard. We talked about Ali's will to win. Clark's will to win was the ultimate team player. That said, I would say the Flyers' most skilled player may have been McLeish, at least at that time. Barber, later in his career, more late 70s, may have pretty skilled himself. But and another thing people forget about McLeish that really needs to be brought up. I mean, we all know he scored the winning goal, you know, in Game 6 and then held up for 1-0 victory. And Bernie Parent, people remember that more as well. He scored that goal and then, you know, Parent held it from there. But, you know, he was the leading scorer in the playoffs the first year they won the Cup. And the second year they won the Cup, he was the leading scorer in the playoffs. And Bernie Parent certainly deserved to win, you know, playoff MVP. But if there was a rule against goalies winning it, or if there was anybody else that would be in the conversation, it would have definitely been McLeish. I went back, you know, the Flyers really, when you, again, you had to kind of be in the moment, everybody focuses on the Boston series. If they don't get by the Rangers, you know, there is no Boston series. And the Rangers, and again, in retrospect, may have been the second-best team in the league that year. Probably whoever won that Flyers-Rangers series, maybe it was a little bit better in Boston at that point in the season. And that was a series where neither team won at home. It was a brutal series. And Game 7, I went back. It's on YouTube. I watched the whole game. McLeish was the dominant player. Not kind of Perron played very well, but McLeish was the dominant player on the ice. He was just a step faster than everybody else. He was, you know, he was phenomenal in that game. And you know, they don't win that game, they never win a cup. And if they don't win the first cup, maybe they only win the second cup. So, you know, and then the third year, you know, the Flyers were, and they say, well, the Flyers were missing Bernie Parent in that series against Montreal. They're also missing McLeish. McLeish was injured. You know, so I have to put those two together as really the guys who were tremendous in the postseason. The 2 years they won the Cup, and the two guys who were missing the third year, they got swept by Montreal, but I think they were all one-goal games until Game 4 when I think it was a two-goal game. So, you know, it could have gone either way, especially if you had, you know, the guy who had been your top playoff scorer. You know, and a lot goes into that. I mean, Clark maybe played more of a checking role and was out there for a lot of penalty killing and things like that. But, you know, McLeish really played a vital role. And you're talking about the first 50-goal scorer in team history. He had another year where he had 49 goals, you know, and had a bunch of 30-goal seasons and, you know, really was, you know, had just unbelievable skills. And he was almost like a comic book character, you know, a superhero in a comic book, you know, that had like, you know, that long hair and flew at the speed of sound and had that faster shot and, you know, and you almost, he had that aura of invincibility, and not one of those people you think of ever getting older. I remember seeing him play at the Spectrum when he was playing for the Hartford Whalers. He scored a goal, and I remember everybody saying, you know, he's still the same guy. And, you know, he never seemed like he was going to get old. And so it kind of hits you when he dies, you know. Yeah, so.
He was a good Flyer, too, because, I mean, he had this, you're right, unbelievably talented player, but he was a skilled player, but not a finesse player. You know, he wasn't the make the cute little move, but you know, shy away from the physical contact. I mean, he was a physical force. He wasn't a super big guy, but he, you know, he was short or, you know, medium height, and but he was a strong player with the puck, strong in the puck, and he had that lethal wrist shot, the patented move where he would start on the right side and move toward the left and just fire that wrist shot back off and back the other way. And he was their most dangerous scorer. And Gordon, I think by bringing up the Rangers series in 73-74, highlights the point about McLeish, which I think most people, if you ask them, remember with that, from that series, it's probably Dave Schultz beating up Dale Ralph and none of the Rangers coming to his defense. And right. You're right. You watched, you know, if you watch the games at the time, you know, McLeish was just an amazing force. And like I said, I think, you know, with between Clark and Dornhofer and the Hound and Bernie and Bruce and all that stuff, and I think people get lost. The other thing, you talk about talent, but I wish I could remember who I read this from, and I've read so much stuff on McLeish earlier this week. Someone talked about an article, you know, I was a reporter who from the time, you know, that goal that won the Stanley Cup in the 1-0 game over Bruins in Game 6, the first cup, McLeish used to practice that with Moose DuPont all the time. DuPont would shoot the point, and McLeish would... Is that
I put that in my column.
I know it's some excellent writer. It was you.
Yeah, I mean, somebody else may have put it too. I don't think it's a secret. I had never heard it before until I actually spoke with McLeish at one time, and he mentioned that how they worked on it because DuPont was playing more on the power play as a playoff. I think DuPont scored by 4 goals in the postseason. We only had like 4 in the regular season that year, and they were using more in the power play because he kind of had that accurate shot. And Bladen and Barber, forget it; their shots were just too hard and all over the place. But they kind of worked on that in practice, where just keep a couple inches off the ground, and he would skate in front. And the first time it ever worked in a game was that game. So, yeah,
I knew it was a great writer I read it from. So check out GordonCollum@SportsMax.com, and you can read it as well. Gordon, it's crunch time here for the Eagles because so far it's been all voluntary. But coming up, the physical's tomorrow. Mandatory camp starts Tuesday. Will Fletcher Cox be there? And if not, what happens?
Well, I think they've kind of set a precedent now with Sam Bradford that they sort of, you know, said it's okay and they you know, it's all right and we'll still, if you're still a good boy and Santa will still bring you gifts and it'll be okay, and here's a lollipop, and you still have your job, and, you know, so I think that sends a signal you can't, you know, all of a sudden play hardball with a guy like Fletcher Cox. You know, if I'm, again, you know, I've said all along with Sam Bradford, I could understand where he was coming from, even though I can understand where the team's coming from. They can't base their whole future on, you know, a guy who's been injured that much. You know, I can understand certainly where Fletcher Cox is coming from, and a little less where the team's coming from, because, you know, it's been publicly stated by Howie Roseman, who usually plays his cards close to the vest with financial matters. He's a dominant player in this league, and he's going to be paid as a dominant player. And I really thought he was going to get his payday this offseason, and he didn't, you know. And, I guess they're going to wait till next season or find another time to do it. But, you know, I'm sure he felt things were said to his agent, things were said publicly, and I'm sure he feels like he should get paid. End of the day, you know, the teams have all the leverage. You know, the players can make a little statement by not showing up. At the end of the day, what choice does he have but to come in? So, you know, will he be there? Will he be there the first day? Will he you know, try to draw more attention to himself? He's not that type of guy, really. I mean, apparently he's a very, you know, low-key kind of guy. He doesn't do dances after he gets a sack or that kind of thing. And, you know, he's more of a team guy. He's starting to really come into his own as a player on the national stage, and we've known how good of a player he is, you know, the last 2 years especially. He deserves to get paid. I know the money's not really there in the cap right now, so they're going to have to be creative. Pretty much any money, if they Jason Peters maybe moves on after this year, the money would be there for Fletcher Cox. But end of the day, he's going to have to come in, and he's going to have to be, you know, he's going to have to take the paycheck that I think the rest of us would gladly take and until it's negotiated.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens. It'll be big news this week. And I get question is, are we going to get an unhappy Fletcher Cox, or, you know, and will that be, not that he'll be disruptive, but will. But anyway, that's it for the live show. Thank you for everybody for listening. Check out PhillyTonight.com. Read Gordon's column, my column, our Ali stuff. And now we move into archive. And Gordon, a week ago, I almost lined up a guest, one of our Phillies writer friends. I was going to try to get Kevin Cooney to talk about the baseball draft. And thank goodness I didn't do that, because that went from being our top story to like our fourth story, and now we're hitting here in archive. Thursday's the amateur draft starts Thursday, and the Phillies do have the number one pick, just like the 76ers will in the NBA draft later this month. You know, there's a couple guys out there, pitchers, position players, and then I've even heard it. I haven't heard it this week, but I think it might have been from Kevin a couple weeks ago. The idea that the Phillies, if there's not one guy they really like, they might even be willing to trade down a couple spots if somebody really wants to jump up and grab somebody. You know, who's the guy you think they're targeting, and what do you think they're going to do Thursday? Not that any of us really know, but what do you think?
I think they've kind of gone back and forth, just from the sense I get. There's this kid from that they're really high on from South Jersey. Was it Groom or something? Yeah.
Jason Groom, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he sounds like, you know, it just, to me, I just kind of get these Jesse Biddle shivers down my spine a little bit, you know. you know, just because I guess he's local.
That shiver wouldn't be down your spine, it would be down your left arm, I believe.
Yeah, right. So, you know, I don't want to lump him. I've never seen a kid pitch, and I understand he's lights out and a real student of the game, art of pitching, and you know, but he is 18. I mean, he is in high school, and so you are going to have to wait a while. We kind of saw how quick the learning curve was with a guy like Aaron Nola, you know, and now he's up and pitching well and in the big leagues, just a really short time after being drafted out of college. So, you know, if they want to have that same impact and really have a staff, that could, a young staff that would be formidable, and have a righty-lefty at the top, you know, I think A.J. Puck, you know, pitched so well this year. You know, for a while, his stock kind of fell. I think some people felt he wasn't always pitching up to his capabilities, and he was sort of an unfinished package. But, you know, he had a dominating performance recently, and the Phillies apparently had, like, five scouts at the game. I think they ended up his team ended up losing. It was against LSU. Ended up losing in 12 innings, but he pitched like 7-plus innings of like lights out, you know, one hit or two hits and a bunch of strikeouts. And you know, you're talking about a guy who's 6'7", maybe even taller, and left-handed, and throws close to 100 miles an hour. I think he was clocked at 97 in that game. So, you know, if I have to pick, if someone says, who are you picking? He's who I'm picking. And I wouldn't be surprised if they pick as well. And that said, I would not be opposed to a position player either, although they are pretty well stocked now in position players. You know, there's some outfielders that are rated pretty highly. Their catching situation doesn't look as dire as it once was. And, you know, so, you know, and they have a shortstop in the future, although he's kind of struggling right now at AAA. But, you know, so you put all that into consideration, and when you're talking about, I mean, you get deeper in the draft, you can't really worry about what we have already and what we don't have. You just have to trust your scouts and just draft people and throw them into your system and see where they fall. But, you know, you really want to project where this guy, what his path is going to be and where he fits in. And, you know, the chance to have a guy who maybe in a year or two could be, you know, right there is 1-2 with Aaron Nola at the top of your rotation, I think is something that you really can't pass up.
Yeah. The one thing I think they're not going to do, and I don't think Jason Groom falls in this category you mentioned, but just trying to read into what Matt Klentak has said this past week, I don't think they're going to sign a high school player where there's a question whether they're going to be able to get them a sign or not. I don't think the Phillies want to pick somebody and then have that guy go to college, you know, not come back for 3 years. I think that's the one guy the one type of guy they're going to avoid. And you know, there's a pitcher out of California, Matt Manning, who fits into that, and there's a couple other guys who fit into that. So, yeah, I think you're going to get either a college player like Puck, Gordon, or you're going to get, you know, a different college player, or you're going to get a high school kid about whom there's no question they're going to come out. I mean, you know, some of the other names in there, there's an outfielder, Kyle Lewis, and God knows the Phillies could use some outfielders. There's, what's the other guy's name, Mickey Moniak. who's a high school outfielder, rather than a college outfielder, who's a high school outfielder. Certainly a possibility. You know, you keep hearing Groom's name, but somehow I don't think they're going to pick him. I think you're right. So we'll see. But it's an important pick, and we won't know whether they made the right pick for a couple of years. It's always the trick with the draft in baseball. In basketball, I think we'll be able to figure out whether the Sixers made the right pick a lot quicker than we will with the Phillies. Although, like you said, with a college pitcher like Nola, we get to see them a lot sooner, and you can see the adjustment because they're older, if they're going to make it or not. I mean, those high school pitchers, Gordon, you and I watched enough of them. You never know. You just don't know if they're going to make it or not. All right. Well, with that, let's turn to final thoughts, Gordon. You're up first.
Yeah, one quick final thought. First of all, on the Phillies draft, and because they're picking first in each round, I think their second round pick is really big as well, because that's almost like another first round pick. You know, so I literally am interested to see what they do there. If they back themselves up with another pitcher, if they go position player there, or if they go high school, if they go college. So I'm really interested to see what they do in the second round and maybe even in the third. You know, because they are you are picking first in each round, and I think that's that is an advantage, and I hope they take advantage of the advantage. So, a few years ago, the Phillies decided to sell alcohol at games, and this didn't sit well with me. I'm not a big fan of the alcohol and beer flows at Eagles games, but I understand it's a little bit more ingrained in the football culture. But, I always felt like baseball is more of a foul atmosphere. It's one of the reasons I kind of like going to Reading. I'm not saying beer isn't sold at Reading, but it doesn't seem to be, as popular an item as it is, and I haven't been to a Phillies game in a couple of years. But, we have heard stories about some behavior that goes on, and it does seem to correlate to when they started selling alcohol. And there was a recent story that came out. Actually, I just saw it this morning, I believe. Here, last night or this morning, somebody threw a beer bottle at Ryan Howard. Now, I know the situation with Ryan Howard is very, it's not a great situation, it's tough for him. It's tough for the team. It's, you can boo him when he comes up, I guess. So that's not really going to help much either. But to throw a beer bottle at a guy who's really giving you some, Ryan Howard will go down and where he goes to the American League and fades away as some sort of like halftime, part-time DH or whatever. He'll be remembered as a guy who had some great years early in his career, with the Philadelphia Phillies, who really just at it for a time was going to look like he was going to be one of the all-time great sluggers in the game until he got injured. And he did it here with the Philadelphia Phillies. And to think that, that something dangerous like a beer bottle is being hurled at him, and I don't know the person who threw it, and I don't know if they were inebriated or not, but I would take a wild guess, if I could, that person maybe was inebriated, or if you create that type of environment there, and I know they want to do things to draw people to the park, and but it's just, to me, it's just, it's not the kind of thing that should go on, period, or go on there, I was just, as much as the Ryan Howard situation is a real tough situation for him and for the team, and you would wish you could just call a press conference one day and say, I retire, and, everybody would find that admirable and everything. I mean, he's going out there, and I guess he's trying his best, and, he's still putting on a uniform every day, and until the situation's resolved, you can think what you want to think, but to do something like that, to me, really didn't sit well at all.
Yeah, I absolutely 100% agree with you. I mean, whoever it is, I guess didn't actually hit him, so I guess you don't press charges, but that person really should never be allowed to go to Phillies game again, period. That's it. Let me hit my own final thought there, and I think we've lost Gordon here. He dropped off the phone, but Fred Katona, it's a tough week for me. Three deaths. And, they always say the deaths come in three. Well, for me, it did this week in sports, and that is Rick McLeish, who I didn't know personally, but, great hockey player, great flyer in my youth. While watching him score, he scored 50 goals, 50 assists in one season. As Gordon talked about extensively, really one of the keys to the Flyers winning that first Stanley Cup and their second Stanley Cup, and maybe could have been a third had he not been injured along with Perron. And, of course, we talked about Muhammad Ali dying, and from afar, admiring what an amazing career in life he's had. But closer to home, in between those two, Fred Katona, and I wrote a column on PhillyFanatics.com about Fred. He was my high school gym teacher. He was also actually my elementary school gym teacher before that. He was my health teacher, and he was my friend. And, boy, when, you know, he just I can't describe to you the number of lives he's influenced. And when you hear – one of the things that really struck me is when you hear gym teacher, coach, athletic director, you figure he'd be close to the athletes and the athletic kids, and he was. But I've really been struck by how many people who have felt close to him or felt influenced by him, kids who describe themselves or now grown-ups who describe themselves as unathletic kids, as non-athletes, as awkward and uncoordinated, and how Fred gave them confidence to do, you know, what they could do. That didn't make them necessarily a great athlete. And also not only that, but he said, hey, you're good at something. You have confidence in yourself. You're great at something. You're not just good at something. You're great at something. And really, it's his legacy that he has so many former students who have talked about his influence. And as I wrote in my column, I'm a teacher myself. If I could have one half the influence with one tenth of the students that I've had, that Fred Katona has had, my career will be a huge success because he was a wonderful man. And when I saw the headline Saturday morning that the greatest had died, I said, "Boy, they finally got around to writing a story about Fred Katona 3 days late." Of course, it was Muhammad Ali, but that headline could apply just as well to Fred Katona. May he rest in peace. Before we get into the show, I also want to send out best regards to Josh Landsberg. Josh, who's regular on the show, hasn't been on with us the past couple of weeks. Been having some health issues, and I talked to him today, and doing better. So I just want to wish Josh a speedy recovery and complete recovery, and look forward to having him back on when he's ready to be back on. That's it for this week's show. For Gordon Glantz, I am Eric Fisher. Have a great week. Check out PhillyFanatics.com, my column on Fred Katona, Gordon's column on Rick McLeish. Lots of good stuff, more good stuff coming. Thank you for listening. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Sunday.